Credible. Finding facts. Most of us put a lot of stock in what scientists tell us because we know that scientists reach their conclusions by gathering and analyzing facts. If someone asked you why you believe that smoking is bad and jogging is good, or that the Earth is round and the galaxy is flat, or that cells are small and molecules are smaller, you'd point to the facts. You might need to explain that you don't personally know the facts to which you're pointing, but that you do know that at some time in the past, a bunch of very earnest people in white lab coats went out and observed the world with stethoscopes, telescopes, and microscopes, wrote down what they observed, analyzed what they wrote down, and then told the rest of us what to believe about nutrition, cosmology, and biology. Scientists are credible because they draw conclusions from observations, and ever since the empiricists trumped the dogmatists and became the kings of ancient Greek medicine, Westerners have had a special reverence for conclusions that are based on things they can see. It isn't surprising, then, that we consider our own views credible when they're based on observable facts, but not when they're based on wishes, wants, and fancies. We might like to believe that everyone loves us, that we will live forever, and that high-tech stocks are preparing to make a major comeback, and it would be awfully convenient if we could just push a little button at the base of our skulls and instantly believe as we wanted. But that's not how believing works. Over the course of human evolution, the brain and the eye have developed a contractual relationship in which the brain has agreed to believe what the eye sees and not to believe what the eye denies. So, if we're to believe something, then it must be supported by, or at least not blatantly contradicted by, the facts. If views are acceptable only when they're credible, and if they're credible only when they're based on facts, then how do we achieve positive views of ourselves and our experience? How do we manage to think of ourselves as great drivers, talented lovers, and brilliant chefs when the facts of our lives include a pathetic parade of dented cars, disappointed partners, and deflated souffles? The answer is simple. We cook the facts. There are many different techniques for collecting, interpreting, and analyzing facts, and different techniques often lead to different conclusions, which is why scientists disagree about the dangers of global warming, the benefits of supply-side economics, and the wisdom of low-carbohydrate diets. Good scientists deal with this complication by choosing the techniques they consider most appropriate and then accepting the conclusions that these techniques produce, regardless of what those conclusions might be. But bad scientists take advantage of this complication by choosing techniques that are especially likely to produce the conclusions they favor, thus allowing them to reach favored conclusions by way of supportive facts. Decades of research suggests that when it comes to collecting and analyzing facts about ourselves and our experiences, most of us have the equivalent of an advanced degree in really bad science. Consider, for instance, the problem of sampling. Because scientists can't observe every bacterium, comet, pigeon, or person, they study small samples that are drawn from these populations. A fundamental rule of good science and common sense is that this sample must be drawn from all parts of the population if it's to tell us about that population. There's really no point in conducting an opinion poll if you're only going to call registered Republicans from Orange County, or the executive membership of anarchists against organizations including this one. And yet, that's pretty much what we do when seeking facts that bear on our favored conclusions. For example, when volunteers in one study were told that they'd scored poorly on an intelligence test and were then given an opportunity to peruse newspaper articles about IQ tests, they spent more time reading articles that questioned the validity of such tests than articles that sanctioned them. When volunteers in another study were given a glowing evaluation by a supervisor, they were more interested in reading background information that praised the supervisor's competence and acumen than background information that impeached it. By controlling the sample of information to which they were exposed, these people indirectly controlled the conclusions they would draw. You've probably done this yourself. For instance, if you've ever purchased a new automobile, you may have noticed that soon after you made the decision to buy the Honda instead of the Toyota, you began lingering over the Honda advertisements in the weekly news magazine and skimming quickly past the ads for the competition. If a friend had noticed this and asked you about it, you would probably have explained that you were simply more interested in learning about the car you'd chosen than about the car you didn't. But learning is an odd choice of words here, because that word usually refers to the balanced acquisition of knowledge. And the kind of learning one does by reading only Honda ads is more than a little lopsided. Ads contain facts about the advantages of the products they describe and not about the disadvantages. And thus your quest for new knowledge would have the interesting side benefit of ensuring that you'd be marinated in those facts and only those facts that confirmed the wisdom of your decision. Not only do we select favorable facts from magazines, we also select them from memory. For example, in one study, some volunteers were shown evidence indicating that extroverts receive higher salaries and more promotions than introverts do, the successful extrovert group. And other volunteers were shown evidence indicating the opposite, the successful introvert group. When the volunteers were asked to recall specific behaviors from their pasts that would help determine whether they were extroverted or introverted, volunteers in the successful extrovert group tended to recall the time when they'd brazenly walked up to a complete stranger and introduced themselves, whereas volunteers in the successful introvert group tended to recall the time when they saw someone they liked but had been too shy to say hello. Of course, other people, and not memories or magazine ads, are the richest sources of information about the wisdom of our decisions, the extent of our abilities, and the irresistible effervescence of our bubbly personalities. Our tendency to expose ourselves to information that supports our favored conclusions is especially powerful when it comes to choosing the company we keep. You've probably noticed that with the exception of Wilt Chamberlain, nobody picks friends and lovers by random sampling. On the contrary, we spend countless hours and countless dollars carefully arranging our lives to ensure that we're surrounded by people who like us and people who are like us. It isn't surprising, then, that when we turn to the folks we know for advice and opinions, they tend to confirm our favored conclusions, either because they share them or because they don't want to hurt our feelings by telling us otherwise. Should the people in our lives occasionally fail to tell us what we want to hear, we have some clever ways of helping them. For example, studies reveal that people have a penchant for asking questions that are subtly engineered to manipulate the answers they receive. A question such as, "Am I the best lover you've ever had?" is dangerous because it has only one answer that can make us truly happy. But a question such as, "What do you like best about my lovemaking?" is brilliant because it has only one answer that can make us truly miserable, or two if you count, "It reminds me of Wilt Chamberlain." Studies show that people intuitively lean towards asking the questions that are most likely to elicit the answers they want to hear. And when they hear those answers, they tend to believe what they've nudged others to say, which is why "Tell me you love me" remains such a popular request. In short, we derive support for our preferred conclusions by listening to the words that we put in the mouths of people who have already been pre-selected for their willingness to say what we want to hear. And it gets worse, because most of us have ways of making other people confirm our favored conclusions without ever engaging them in conversation. Consider this. To be a great driver, lover, or chef, we don't need to be able to parallel park while blindfolded, make 10,000 maidens swoon with a single pucker, or create a pat feuilleté so intoxicating that the entire population of France instantly abandons its national cuisine and swears allegiance to our kitchen. Rather, we simply need to park, kiss, and bake better than most other folks do. How do we know how well most other folks do? Why, we look around, of course. But in order to make sure that we see what we want to see, we look around selectively. For example, volunteers of one study took a test that ostensibly measured their social sensitivity, and were then told that they'd flubbed the majority of the questions. When these volunteers were then given an opportunity to look over the test results of other people who had performed better or worse than they had, they ignored the tests of the people who'd done better and instead spent their time looking over the tests of the people who'd done worse. Getting a C- isn't so bad if one compares oneself exclusively to those who got a D. This tendency to seek information about those who have done more poorly than we have is especially pronounced when the stakes are high. People with life-threatening illnesses such as cancer are particularly likely to compare themselves with those who are in worse shape, which explains why 96% of the cancer patients in one study claimed to be in better health than the average cancer patient. And if we can't find people who are doing more poorly than we are, we may go out and create them. Volunteers in one study took a test and were then given the opportunity to provide hints that would either help or hinder a friend's performance on the same test. Although volunteers helped their friends when the test was described as a game, they actively hindered their friends when the test was described as an important measure of intellectual ability. Apparently, when our friends don't have the good taste to come in last so that we can enjoy the good taste of coming in first, we give them a friendly push in the appropriate direction. Once we've successfully sabotaged their performances and ensured their failure, they become the perfect standard for comparison. The bottom line is this. The brain and the eye may have a contractual relationship in which the brain has agreed to believe what the eye sees, but in return, the eye has agreed to look for what the brain wants. Challenging facts. Whether by choosing information or informants, our ability to cook the facts that we encounter helps us establish views that are both positive and credible. Of course, if you've ever discussed a football game, a political debate, or the 6 o'clock news with someone from the other side of the aisle, you've already discovered that even when people do encounter facts that disconfirm their favored conclusions, they have a knack for ignoring them, forgetting them, or seeing them differently than the rest of us do. When Dartmouth and Princeton students see the same football game, both sets of students claim that the facts clearly show that the other school's team was responsible for the unsportsmanlike conduct. When Democrats and Republicans see the same presidential debate on television, both sets of viewers claim that the facts clearly show that their candidate was the winner. When pro-Israeli and pro-Arab viewers see identical samples of Middle East news coverage, both proponents claim that the facts clearly show that the press was biased against their side. Alas, the only thing these facts clearly show is that people tend to see what they want to see. Inevitably, however, there will be times when the unkind facts are just too obvious to set aside. When our team's defensive tackle is caught wearing brass knuckles, or when our candidate confesses to embezzlement on national television, we find it difficult to overlook or forget such facts. How do we manage to maintain a favored conclusion when the brute facts just won't cooperate? Although the word fact seems to suggest a sort of unquestionable irrefutability, facts are actually nothing more than conjectures that have met a certain standard of proof. If we set that standard high enough, then nothing can ever be proved, including the fact of our own existence. If we set the standard low enough, then all things are true and equally so. Because nihilism and postmodernism are both such unsatisfying philosophies, we tend to set our standard of proof somewhere in the middle. No one can say precisely where that standard should be set, but one thing we do know is that wherever we set it, we must keep it in the same place when we evaluate the facts we favor and the facts we don't. It would be unfair for teachers to give the students they like easier exams than those they dislike, or for federal regulators to require that foreign products pass stricter safety tests than domestic products, or for judges to insist that the defense attorney make better arguments than the prosecutor. And yet, this is just the sort of uneven treatment most of us give to facts that confirm and disconfirm our favored conclusions. In one study, volunteers were asked to evaluate two pieces of scientific research on the effectiveness of capital punishment as a deterrent. They were shown one research study that used the between states technique, which involved comparing the crime rates of states that had capital punishment with the crime rates of states that didn't, and one research study that used the within states technique, which involved comparing the crime rates of a single state before and after it instituted or outlawed capital punishment. For half the volunteers, the between states study concluded that capital punishment was effective, and the within states study concluded it was not. For the other half of the volunteers, these conclusions were reversed. The results showed that volunteers favored whichever technique produced the conclusion that verified their own personal political ideologies. When the within states technique produced an unfavorable conclusion, volunteers immediately recognized that within states comparisons are worthless because factors such as employment and income vary over time, and thus crime rates in one decade, for example, the 1980s, can't be compared with crime rates in another decade, for example, the 1990s. But when the between states technique produced an unfavorable conclusion, volunteers immediately recognized that between states comparisons are worthless because factors such as employment and income vary with geography, and thus crime rates in one place, such as Alabama, can't be compared with crime rates in another place, such as Massachusetts. Clearly, volunteers set the methodological bar higher for studies that disconfirmed their favored conclusions. This same technique allows us to achieve and maintain a positive and credible view of ourselves and our experiences. For example, volunteers in one study were told that they'd performed very well or very poorly on a social sensitivity test, and were then asked to assess two scientific reports, one that suggested the test was valid and one that suggested it wasn't. Volunteers who'd performed well on the test believe that the studies in the validating report used sounder scientific methods than did the studies in the invalidating report, but volunteers who performed poorly on the test believe precisely the opposite. When facts challenge our favored conclusion, we scrutinize them more carefully and subject them to more rigorous analysis. We also require a lot more of them. For example, how much information would you require before you were willing to conclude that someone was intelligent? Would their high school transcripts be enough? Would an IQ test suffice? Would you need to know what their teachers and employers thought of them? Volunteers in one study were asked to evaluate the intelligence of another person, and they required considerable evidence before they were willing to conclude that the person was truly smart. But interestingly, they required much more evidence when the person was an unbearable pain in the ass than when the person was funny, kind, and friendly. When we want to believe that someone is smart, then a single letter of recommendation may suffice. But when we don't want to believe that a person is smart, we may demand a thick manila folder full of transcripts, tests, and testimony. Precisely the same thing happens when we want or don't want to believe something about ourselves. For instance, volunteers in one study were invited to take a medical test that would supposedly tell them whether they did or didn't have a dangerous enzyme deficiency that could predispose them to pancreatic disorders. The volunteers placed a drop of their saliva on a strip of ordinary paper that the researchers falsely claimed was a medical test strip. Some volunteers were called positive testers. They were told that if the strip turned green in 10 to 60 seconds, then they had the enzyme deficiency. Other volunteers were called negative testers. They were told that if the strip turned green in 10 to 60 seconds, then they didn't have the enzyme deficiency. Although the strip was an ordinary piece of paper and hence never turned green, the negative testers waited much longer than the positive testers before deciding that the test was complete. In other words, the volunteers gave the test strip plenty of time to prove that they were well, but much less time to prove that they were ill. Apparently, it doesn't take much to convince us that we're smart and healthy, but it takes a whole lot of facts to convince us of the opposite. We ask whether facts allow us to believe our favored conclusions and whether they compel us to believe our disfavored conclusions. Not surprisingly, disfavored conclusions have a much tougher time meeting this more rigorous standard of proof. Onward. In July 2004, the City Council of Monza, Italy, took the unusual step of banning goldfish bowls. They reasoned that goldfish should be kept in rectangular aquariums and not in round bowls because, quote, a fish kept in a bowl has a distorted view of reality and suffers because of this, unquote. No mention was made of the bland diet, the noisy pump, or the silly plastic castles. No, the problem was that round bowls deform the visual experience of their inhabitants, and goldfish have the fundamental right to see the world as it really is. The good counselors of Monza didn't suggest that human beings should enjoy the same right, perhaps because they knew that our distorted views of reality aren't so easily dispelled, or perhaps because they understood that we suffer less with them than we would without them. Distorted views of reality are made possible by the fact that experiences are ambiguous, that is, they can be credibly viewed in many ways, some of which are more positive than others. To ensure that our views are credible, our brain accepts what our eye sees. To ensure that our views are positive, our eye looks for what our brain wants. The conspiracy between these two servants allows us to live at the fulcrum of stark reality and comforting illusion. So what does all of this have to do with forecasting our emotional futures? As we're about to see, we may live at the fulcrum of reality and illusion, but most of us don't know our own address. Chapter 9. Immune to Reality. Upon my back to defend my belly, upon my wit to defend my wiles, upon my secrecy to defend mine honesty, my mask to defend my beauty. Shakespeare, Troilus and Cressida. Albert Einstein may have been the greatest genius of the 20th century, but few people know that he came this close to losing that distinction to a horse. Wilhelm von Osten was a retired schoolteacher who in 1891 claimed that his stallion, whom he called Clever Hans, could answer questions about current events, mathematics, and a host of other topics by tapping the ground with his foreleg. For instance, when Osten would ask Clever Hans to add 3 and 5, The horse would wait until his master had finished asking the question, tap 8 times, then stop. Sometimes, instead of asking a question, Osten would write it on a card and hold it up for Clever Hans to read, and the horse seemed to understand written language every bit as well as it understood speech. Clever Hans didn't get every question right, of course, but he did much better than anyone else with hooves, and his public performances were so impressive that he soon became the toast of Berlin. But in 1904, the director of the Berlin Psychological Institute sent his student, Oscar Fungst, to look into the matter more carefully. And Fungst noticed that Clever Hans was much more likely to give the wrong answer when Osten was standing in back of the horse than in front of it, or when Osten himself did not know the answer to the question the horse had been asked. In a series of clever experiments, Clever Fungst was able to show that Clever Hans could indeed read, but that what he could read was Osten's body language. When Osten bent slightly, Clever Hans would start tapping, and when Osten straightened up, or tilted his head a bit, or faintly raised an eyebrow, Clever Hans would stop. In other words, Osten was signaling Clever Hans to start and stop tapping at just the right moments to create the illusion of horse sense. Clever Hans was no genius, but Osten was no fraud. Indeed, he'd spent years patiently talking to his horse about mathematics and world affairs, and he was genuinely shocked and dismayed to learn that he'd been fooling himself as well as everyone else. The deception was elaborate and effective, but it was perpetrated unconsciously, and in this, Osten was not unique. When we expose ourselves to favorable facts, notice and remember favorable facts, and hold favorable facts to a fairly low standard of proof, we're generally no more aware of our subterfuge than Osten was of his. We may refer to the processes by which the psychological immune system does its job as tactics or strategies, but these terms, with their inevitable connotations of planning and deliberation, shouldn't cause us to think of people as manipulative schemers who are consciously trying to generate positive views of their own experience. On the contrary, research suggests that people are typically unaware of the reasons why they're doing what they're doing, but when asked for a reason, they readily supply one. For example, when volunteers watch a computer screen on which words appear for just a few milliseconds, they're unaware of seeing the words and unable to guess which words they saw, but they are influenced by them. When the word hostile is flashed, volunteers judge others negatively. When the word elderly is flashed, volunteers walk slowly. When the word stupid is flashed, volunteers perform poorly on tests. When these volunteers are later asked to explain why they judged, walked, or scored the way they did, two things happen. First, they don't know. And second, they don't say, "I don't know." Instead, their brains quickly consider the facts of which they are aware, for example, that they walked slowly, and draw the same kinds of plausible but mistaken inferences about themselves that an observer would probably draw about them, for example, that they were tired. When we cook facts, we're similarly unaware of why we're doing it, and this turns out to be a good thing because deliberate attempts to generate positive views, "There must be something good about bankruptcy, and I'm not leaving this chair until I discover it," contain the seeds of their own destruction. Volunteers in one study listened to Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Some were told to listen to the music, and others were told to listen to the music while consciously trying to be happy. At the end of the interlude, the volunteers who had tried to be happy were in a worse mood than were the volunteers who had simply listened to the music. Why? Two reasons. First, we may be able deliberately to generate positive views of our own experiences if we close our eyes, sit very still, and do nothing else, but research suggests that if we become even slightly distracted, these deliberate attempts tend to backfire, and we end up feeling worse than we did before. Second, deliberate attempts to cook the facts are so transparent that they make us feel cheap. Sure, we want to believe that we're better off without the fiancé who left us standing at the altar, and we will feel better soon as we begin to discover facts that support this conclusion. She was never really right for me, was she, Mom? But the process by which we discover those facts must feel like a discovery and not like a snow job. If we see ourselves cooking the facts, if I phrase the question just this way and ask nobody but Mom, I stand a pretty good chance of having my favored conclusion confirmed, then the jig is up and self-deluded joins jilted in our list of pitiful qualities. For positive views to be credible, they must be based on facts that we believe we have come upon honestly. We accomplish this by unconsciously cooking the facts and then consciously consuming them. The diner is in the dining room, but the chef is in the basement. The benefit of all this unconscious cookery is that it works, but the cost is that it makes us strangers to ourselves. Let me tell you how. Looking forward to looking backward. To my knowledge, no one has ever done a systematic study of people who've been left standing at the altar by a cold-footed fiancé. But I'm willing to bet a good bottle of wine that if you rounded up a healthy sample of almost brides and nearly grooms and asked them whether they would describe the incident as the worst thing that ever happened to me or the best thing that ever happened to me, more would endorse the latter description than the former. And I'll bet an entire case of that wine that if you found a sample of people who'd never been through this experience and asked them to predict which of all their possible future experiences they're most likely to look back on as the best thing that ever happened to me, not one of them will list getting jilted. Like so many things, getting jilted is more painful in prospect and more rosy in retrospect. When we contemplate being hung out to dry this way, we naturally generate the most dreadful possible view of the experience. But once we've actually been heartbroken and humiliated in front of our family, friends, and florists, our brains begin shopping for a less dreadful view. And as we've seen, the human brain is one smart shopper. However, because our brains do their shopping unconsciously, we tend not to realize that they will do it at all. Hence, we blithely assume that the dreadful view we have when we look forward to the event is the dreadful view we'll have when we look back on it. In short, we don't realize that our views will change because we're normally unaware of the processes that change them. This fact can make it quite difficult to predict one's emotional future. In one study, volunteers were given the opportunity to apply for a good-paying job that involved nothing more than tasting ice cream and making up funny names for it. The application procedure required the volunteer to undergo an on-camera interview. Some of the volunteers were told that their interview would be seen by a judge who had sole discretionary authority to decide whether they would be hired. Other volunteers were told that their interview would be seen by a jury whose members would vote to decide whether the volunteer should be hired. These volunteers were told that as long as one juror voted for them, they would get the job, and thus the only circumstance under which they wouldn't get the job was if the jury voted unanimously against them. All of the volunteers then underwent an interview, and all predicted how they would feel if they didn't get the job. A few minutes later, the researcher came into the room and explained apologetically that, after careful deliberation, the judge or jury had decided that the volunteer just wasn't quite right for the job. The researcher then asked the volunteers to report how they felt. The results of the study showed that volunteers in the two groups expected to feel equally unhappy. After all, rejection is a major whack on the nose, and we expect it to hurt whether the whacker is a judge, a jury, or a gang of Orthodox rabbis. But these expectations were wrong. In fact, volunteers were more unhappy when they were rejected by a unanimous jury than when they were rejected by a capricious judge. Why? Well, just imagine that you've applied for a job as a swimsuit model, which requires that you don something skimpy and parade back and forth in front of some gimlet-eyed twit in a $3 suit. If the twit looked you over, shook his head, and said, "Sorry, but you're not model material," you'd probably feel bad. For a minute or two. But this is the sort of interpersonal rejection that everyone experiences from time to time, and after a few minutes, most of us get over it and on with our lives. We do this quickly because our psychological immune systems have no trouble finding ways to exploit the ambiguity of this experience and soften its sting. The guy wasn't paying attention to my extraordinary pivot, or he's one of those weirdos who prefers height to weight, or I'm supposed to take fashion advice from a guy with a suit like that. But now imagine that you've just modeled the skimpy thing for a whole room full of people. Some men, some women, some old, some young. And they all look you over and shake their heads in unison. You'd probably feel bad, truly bad, humiliated, hurt, and confused. You'd probably hurry off stage with a warm feeling in your ears, a tight feeling in your throat, and a wet feeling in your eyes. Being rejected by a large and diverse group of people is a demoralizing experience because it's so thoroughly unambiguous, and hence it's difficult for the psychological immune system to find a way to think about it that is both positive and credible. It's easy to blame failure on the eccentricities of a judge, but it's much more difficult to blame failure on the eccentricities of a unanimous jury. Claims such as, "A synchronized mass blink caused 94 people to miss my pivot at precisely the same moment," are just not credible. Similarly, volunteers in this study found it easier to blame their rejection on an idiosyncratic judge than on a panel of jurors, which is why they felt worse when they were rejected by a jury. Now, All this may seem painfully obvious to you as you contemplate the results of this study from the comfort of your sofa, but allow me to suggest that it's painfully obvious only after someone has taken pains to point it out to you. Indeed, if it were really painfully obvious, then why were a bunch of smart volunteers unable to predict that it would happen just a few minutes before it did? Why didn't the volunteers realize that they would have more success blaming a judge than a jury? Because when volunteers were asked to predict their emotional reactions to rejection, they imagined its sharp sting. Period. They didn't go on to imagine how their brains might try to relieve that sting. Because they were unaware that they would alleviate their suffering by blaming those who caused it, it never occurred to them that they would be more successful if a single person were to blame rather than an entire group. Other studies have confirmed this general finding. For example, people expect to feel equally bad when a tragic accident is the result of human negligence as when it's the result of dumb luck, but they actually feel worse when luck is dumb and no one is blameworthy. Ignorance of our psychological immune systems causes us to mispredict the circumstances under which we'll blame others, but it also causes us to mispredict the circumstances under which we'll blame ourselves. Who can forget the scene at the end of the 1942 film Casablanca, in which Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman are standing on the tarmac as she tries to decide whether to stay in Casablanca with the man she loves, or board the plane and leave with her husband? Bogey turns to Bergman and says, "Inside, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life." This thin slice of melodrama is among the most memorable scenes in the history of cinema, not because it's particularly well acted or particularly well written, but because most of us have stood on that same runway from time to time. Our most consequential choices, whether to marry, have children, buy a house, enter a profession, move abroad, are often shaped by how we imagine our future regrets. Oh no, I forgot to have a baby. Regret is an emotion we feel when we blame ourselves for unfortunate outcomes that might have been prevented had we only behaved differently in the past. And because that emotion is decidedly unpleasant, our behavior in the present is often designed to preclude it. Indeed, most of us have elaborate theories about when and why people feel regret, and these theories allow us to avoid the experience. For instance, we expect to feel more regret when we learn about alternatives to our choices than when we don't, when we accept bad advice than when we reject good advice, when our bad choices are unusual rather than conventional, and when we fail by a narrow margin rather than by a wide margin. But sometimes these theories are wrong. Consider this scenario. You own shares in Company A. During the past year, you considered switching to stock in Company B, but decided against it. You now find that you would have been better off by $1,200 if you'd switched to the stock of Company B. You also own shares in Company C. During the past year, you switched to stock in Company D. You now find that you'd have been better off by $1,200 if you kept your stock in Company C. Which error causes you more regret? Studies show that about 9 out of 10 people expect to feel more regret when they foolishly switch stocks than when they foolishly fail to switch stocks, because most people think they'll regret foolish actions more than foolish inactions. But studies also show that 9 out of 10 people are wrong. Indeed, in the long run, people of every age and in every walk of life seem to regret not having done things much more than they regret things they did, which is why the most popular regrets include not going to college, not grasping profitable business opportunities, and not spending enough time with family and friends. But why do people regret inactions more than actions? Well, one reason is that the psychological immune system has a more difficult time manufacturing positive and credible views of inactions than of actions. When our action causes us to accept a marriage proposal from someone who later becomes an axe murderer, we can console ourselves by thinking of all the things we learned from the experience. For example, that collecting hatchets isn't a healthy hobby. But when our inaction causes us to reject a marriage proposal from someone who later becomes a movie star, we can't console ourselves by thinking of all the things we learned from the experience because, well, there wasn't one. The irony is all too clear. Because we don't realize that our psychological immune systems can rationalize an excess of courage more easily than an excess of cowardice, we hedge our bets when we should blunder forward. As students of the silver screen recall, Bogart's admonition about future regret led Bergman to board the plane and fly away with her husband. Had she stayed with Bogey in Casablanca, she would probably have felt just fine. Not right away, perhaps, but soon, and for the rest of her life. Little Triggers. Civilized people have learned the hard way that a handful of iniquitous individuals can often cause more death and destruction than an invading army. If an enemy were to launch hundreds of airplanes and missiles against the United States, the odds are that none would reach its target, because an offensive strike of that magnitude would trigger America's defensive systems, which are presumably adequate to quash the threat. On the other hand, were an enemy to launch seven guys with baggy pants and baseball caps, those men might well reach their targets and detonate bombs, release toxins, or fly hijacked airplanes into tall buildings. Terrorism is a strategy based on the idea that the best offense is the one that fails to trigger the best defense. And small-scale incursions are less likely to set off the alarm bells than are large-scale assaults. Although it is possible to design a defensive system that counters even the smallest threat by using electrified borders, a travel ban, electronic surveillance, random searches, and so on, such systems are extraordinarily costly in terms of both the resources required to run them and the number of false alarms they produce. A system like that would be an exercise in overkill. To be effective, a defensive system must respond to threats, but to be practical, it must respond only to threats that exceed some critical threshold, which means that threats that fall short of the critical threshold may have a destructive potential that belies their diminutive size. Unlike large threats, small threats can sneak in under the radar. The intensity trigger. The psychological immune system is a defensive system, and it obeys this same principle. When experiences make us feel sufficiently unhappy, the psychological immune system cooks facts and shifts blame in order to offer us a more positive view. But it doesn't do this every time we feel the slightest tingle of sadness, jealousy, anger, or frustration. Failed marriages and lost jobs are the kind of large-scale assaults on our happiness that trigger our psychological defenses. But these defenses aren't triggered by broken pencils, stubbed toes, or slow elevators. Broken pencils may be annoying, but they don't pose a grave threat to our psychological well-being and hence don't trigger our psychological defenses. The paradoxical consequence of this fact is that it's sometimes more difficult to achieve a positive view of a bad experience than of a very bad experience. For example, volunteers in one study were students who were invited to join an extracurricular club whose initiation ritual required that they receive 3 electric shocks. Some of the volunteers had a truly dreadful experience because the shocks they received were quite severe, and others had a slightly unpleasant experience because the shocks they received were relatively mild. Although you might expect people to dislike anything associated with physical pain, the volunteers who received the severe initiation actually liked the club more. Because these volunteers suffered greatly, the intensity of their suffering triggered their defensive systems, which immediately began working to help them achieve a credible and positive view of their experience. It isn't easy to find such a view, but it can be done. For example, physical suffering is bad. Oh my God, that really hurt! But it isn't entirely bad if the thing one suffers for is extremely valuable. But I'm joining a very elite group of very special people. Indeed, research shows that when people are given electric shocks, they actually feel less pain when they believe they're suffering for something of great value. The intense shocks were unpleasant enough to trigger the volunteers' psychological defenses, but the mild shocks weren't. Hence, the volunteers valued the club most when its initiation was most painful. If you've managed to forgive your spouse for some egregious transgression, but still find yourself miffed about the dent in the garage door or the trail of dirty socks on the staircase, then you've experienced this paradox. Intense suffering triggers the very processes that eradicate it, while mild suffering does not, and this counterintuitive fact can make it difficult for us to predict our emotional futures. For example, would it be worse if your best friend insulted you or insulted your cousin? As much as you may like your cousin, it's a pretty good bet that you like yourself more. Hence, you probably think that it would be worse if the epithet were hurled your way. And you're right. It would be worse. At first. But if intense suffering triggers the psychological immune system, and mild suffering doesn't, then over time you should be more likely to generate a positive view of an insult that was directed at you. Felicia called me a pea brain. Boy, she can really crack me up sometimes. Than one that was directed at your cousin. Felicia called Cousin Duane a pea brain. I mean, she's right, of course, but it wasn't very nice of her to say. The irony is that you may ultimately feel better when you're the victim of an insult than when you're a bystander to it. This possibility was tested in a study in which two volunteers took a personality test, and then one of them received feedback from a psychologist. The feedback was professional, detailed, and unrelentingly negative. For example, it contained statements such as, "You have few qualities that distinguish you from others," and "People like you primarily because you don't threaten their competence." Both of the volunteers read the feedback and then reported how much they liked the psychologist who'd written it. Ironically, the volunteer who was the victim of the negative feedback liked the psychologist more than did the volunteer who was merely a bystander to it. Why? Because bystanders were miffed when they learned that the psychologist had done something crummy to the other volunteer for no good reason, but they weren't devastated. Hence, their psychological immune systems did nothing to ameliorate their mildly negative feelings. But victims were devastated. Hence, their brains quickly went shopping for a positive view of the experience. But now that I think of it, that test could only provide a small glimpse into my very complex personality, so I rather doubt it means much. Now, here's the important finding. When a new group of volunteers was asked to predict how much they would like the psychologist, they predicted that they would like the psychologist less if they were victims than if they were bystanders. Apparently, people aren't aware of the fact that their defenses are more likely to be triggered by intense than mild suffering. Thus, they mispredict their own emotional reactions to misfortunes of different sizes. The inescapability trigger. Intense suffering is one factor that can trigger our defenses and thus influence our experience in ways we don't anticipate. But there are others. For example, why do we forgive our siblings for behavior we would never tolerate in a friend? Why aren't we disturbed when the president does something that would have kept us from voting for him had he done it before the election? Why do we overlook an employee's chronic tardiness but refuse to hire a job seeker who's 2 minutes late for the interview? One possibility is that blood's thicker than water, flags were made to be rallied around, and first impressions matter most. But another possibility is that we're more likely to look for, and find, a positive view of things we're stuck with than of things we're not. Friends come and go, and changing candidates is as easy as changing socks. But siblings and presidents are ours, for better or for worse, and there's not much we can do about it once they've been born or elected. When the experience we're having is not the experience we want to be having, our first reaction is to go out and have a different one, which is why we return unsatisfactory rental cars, check out of bad hotels, and stop hanging around with people who pick their noses in public. It's only when we can't change the experience that we look for ways to change our view of the experience, which is why we love the clunker in the driveway, the shabby cabin that's been in the family for years, and Uncle Sheldon, despite his predilection for nasal spelunking. We find silver linings only when we must, which is why people experience an increase in happiness when genetic tests reveal that they don't have a dangerous genetic defect, or when the tests reveal that they do have a dangerous genetic defect, but not when the tests are inconclusive. We just can't make the best of a fate until it's inescapably, inevitably, and irrevocably ours. Inescapable, inevitable, and irrevocable circumstances trigger the psychological immune system. But, as with the intensity of suffering, people don't always recognize that this will happen. For example, college students in one study signed up for a course in black and white photography. Each student took a dozen photographs of people and places that were personally meaningful, then reported for a private lesson. In these lessons, the teacher spent an hour or two showing students how to print their two best photographs. When the prints were dry and ready, the teacher said that the students could keep one of the photographs, but that the other would be kept on file as an example of student work. Some students were assigned to the inescapable group, and students in this group were told that once they had chosen a photograph to take home, they wouldn't be allowed to change their minds. Other students were assigned to the escapable group, and these students were told that once they'd chosen a photograph to take home, they'd have several days to change their mind. And if they did, the teacher would gladly swap the photograph they'd taken home for the one they'd left behind. Students made their choices and took one of their photographs home. Several days later, the students responded to a survey, asking them how much they liked their photographs. The results showed that students in the escapable group liked their photographs less than did students in the inescapable group. Interestingly, when a new group of students was asked to predict how much they'd like their photographs if they were or weren't given the opportunity to change their minds, these students predicted that escapability would have no influence whatsoever on their satisfaction with the photograph. Apparently, inescapable circumstances trigger the psychological defenses that enable us to achieve positive views of those circumstances, but we don't anticipate that this will happen. Our failure to anticipate that inescapability will trigger our psychological immune systems, hence promote our happiness and satisfaction, can cause us to make some painful mistakes. For example, when a new group of photography students was asked whether they'd prefer to have or not to have the opportunity to change their minds about which photograph to keep, the vast majority preferred to have that opportunity. That is, the vast majority of students preferred to enroll in a photography course in which they would ultimately be dissatisfied with the photograph they produced. Why would anyone prefer less satisfaction to more? No one does, of course, but most people do seem to prefer more freedom to less. Indeed, when our freedom to make up our minds, or to change our minds once we've made them up, is threatened, we experience a strong impulse to reassert it, which is why retailers sometimes threaten your freedom to own their products with claims such as limited stock or you must order by midnight tonight. Our fetish for freedom leads us to patronize expensive department stores that allow us to return merchandise rather than attend auctions that don't, to lease cars at a dramatic markup rather than buying them at a bargain, and so on. Most of us will pay a premium today for the opportunity to change our minds tomorrow, and sometimes it makes sense to do so. A few days spent test driving a little red roadster tells us a lot about what it might be like to own one. Thus, it's sometimes wise to pay a modest premium for a contract that includes a short refund period. But if keeping our options open has benefits, it also has costs. Little red roadsters are naturally cramped. And while the committed owner will find positive ways to view this fact, wow, it feels like a fighter jet, the buyer whose contract includes an escape clause may not. This car is so tiny, maybe I should return it. Committed owners attend to a car's virtues and overlook its flaws, thus cooking the facts to produce a banquet of satisfaction. But the buyer for whom escape is still possible, and whose defenses have not yet been triggered, is likely to evaluate the new car more critically, paying special attention to its imperfections as she tries to decide whether to keep it. The costs and benefits of freedom are clear, but alas, they're not equally clear. We have no trouble anticipating the advantages that freedom may provide, but we seem blind to the joys it can undermine. Explaining away. If you've ever puked your guts out shortly after eating chili con carne and found yourself unable to eat it again for years, you have a pretty good idea of what it's like to be a fruit fly. No, fruit flies don't eat chili, and no, fruit flies don't puke. But they do associate their best and worst experiences with the circumstances that accompanied and preceded them, which allows them to seek or avoid those circumstances in the future. Expose a fruit fly to the odor of tennis shoes, give it a very tiny electric shock, and for the rest of its very tiny life, it'll avoid places that smell tennis shoey. The ability to associate pleasure or pain with its circumstances is so vitally important that nature has installed that ability in every one of her creatures, from Drosophila melanogaster to Ivan Pavlov. But if that ability is necessary for creatures like us, it certainly isn't sufficient, because the kind of learning it enables is far too limited. If an organism can do no more than associate particular experiences with particular circumstances, then it can learn only a very small lesson, namely, to seek or avoid those particular circumstances in the future. A well-timed shock may teach a fruit fly to avoid the tennis shoe smell, but it won't teach it to avoid the smell of snowshoes, ballet slippers, Manolo Blahnik, or a scientist armed with a miniature stun gun. To maximize our pleasures and minimize our pains, we must be able to associate our experiences with the circumstances that produce them, but we must also be able to explain how and why those circumstances produced the experiences they did. If we feel nauseous after a few turns on the Ferris wheel and our explanation involves poor equilibrium, then we avoid Ferris wheels in the future, just as a fruit fly would. But unlike a fruit fly, we also avoid some things that are not associated with our nauseating experience, such as bungee jumping and sailboats. And we do not avoid some things that are associated with our nauseating experience, such as hurdy-gurdy music and clowns. Unlike a mere association, an explanation allows us to identify particular aspects of a circumstance, for example, spinning, as the cause of our experience, and other aspects, such as music, as irrelevant. In so doing, we learn more from our upchucks than a fruit fly ever could. Explanations allow us to make full use of our experiences, but they also change the nature of those experiences. As we've seen, when experiences are unpleasant, we quickly move to explain them in ways that make us feel better. And indeed, studies show that the mere act of explaining an unpleasant event can help us to defang it. For example, simply writing about a trauma, such as the death of a loved one or a physical assault, can lead to surprising improvements in both subjective well-being and physical health. For example, fewer visits to the physician and improved production of viral antibodies. What's more, the people who experience the greatest benefit from these writing exercises are those whose writing contains an explanation of the trauma. But just as explanations ameliorate the impact of unpleasant events, so too do they ameliorate the impact of pleasant events. For example, college students volunteered for a study in which they believed they were interacting in an online chat room with students from other universities. In fact, they were actually interacting with a sophisticated computer program that simulated the presence of other students. After the simulated students had provided the real student with information about themselves, such as, "Hi, I'm Eva, and I like to do volunteer work," the researcher pretended to ask the simulated students to decide which of the people in the chat room they liked most, to write a paragraph explaining why, and then to send it to that person. In just a few minutes, something remarkable happened. The real student received email messages from every one of the simulated students, indicating that they liked the real student best. For example, one simulated message read, "I just felt that something clicked between us when I read your answers. It's too bad we're not at the same school." Another read, "You stood out as the one I would like the most. I was especially interested in the way you described your interests and values." A third read, "I wish I could talk with you directly because I'd ask you if you like being around water. I love water skiing. And if you like Italian food, it's my favorite." Now, here's the catch. Some real students received email that allowed them to know which simulated student wrote each of the messages, and other real students received email messages that had been stripped of that identifying information. In other words, every real student received exactly the same email messages indicating that they had won the hearts and minds of all the simulated people in the chat room. But only one group of real students knew which simulated individual had written each of the messages. Real students who knew which simulated individual had written each message were able to generate explanations for their good fortune. "Eva appreciates my values because we're both involved with Habitat for Humanity, and it makes sense that Katerina would mention Italian food." But real students who did not know which individual had written each message were not able to generate explanations for their good fortune. "Someone appreciates my values. I wonder who, and why would anyone mention Italian food?" The researchers measured how happy the real students were immediately after receiving these messages and then again 15 minutes later. Although real students in both groups were initially delighted to have been chosen as everyone's best friend, only the real students who did not know which simulated student had written each message remained delighted 15 minutes later. If you've ever had a secret admirer, then you understand why these real students remained on cloud 9 while the other real students quickly descended to clouds 2 through 5. Unexplained events have two qualities that amplify and extend their emotional impact. First, they strike us as rare and unusual. If I told you that my brother, my sister, and I were all born on the same day, you'd probably consider that a rare and unusual occurrence. Once I explained that we were triplets, you'd find it considerably less so. In fact, just about any explanation I offered would tend to reduce the amazingness of the coincidence and make the event seem more probable. Whether it was that by same day I meant that we were all born on a Thursday, or that since we were all delivered by cesarean section, Mom and Dad timed our births for maximum tax benefit. Explanations allow us to understand how and why an event happened, which immediately allows us to see how and why it might happen again. Indeed, whenever we say that something can't happen, for example, mind reading or levitation or a law that limits the power of incumbents, we usually just mean that we'd have no way to explain it if it did. Unexplained events seem rare, and rare events naturally have a greater emotional impact than common events do. We're awed by a solar eclipse, but merely impressed by a sunset, despite the fact that the latter is by far the more spectacular visual treat. The second reason why unexplained events have a disproportionate emotional impact is that we're especially likely to keep thinking about them. People spontaneously try to explain events, and studies show that when people don't complete the things they set out to do, they're especially likely to think about and remember their unfinished business. Once we explain an event, we can fold it up like freshly washed laundry, put it away in memory's drawer, and move on to the next one. But if an event defies explanation, it becomes a mystery or a conundrum. And if there is one thing we all know about mysterious conundrums, it's that they generally refuse to stay in the back of our minds. Filmmakers and novelists often capitalize on this fact by fitting their narratives with mysterious endings, and research shows that people are, in fact, more likely to keep thinking about a movie when they can't explain what happened to the main character. And if they liked the movie, this morsel of mystery causes them to remain happy longer. Explanation robs events of their emotional impact because it makes them seem likely and allows us to stop thinking about them. Oddly enough, an explanation doesn't actually have to explain anything to have these effects. It merely needs to seem as though it does. For instance, in one study, a researcher approached college students in the university library, handed them one of two cards with a dollar coin attached, and then walked away. You'd probably agree that this is a curious event that begs for explanation. One card simply said, "The Smile Society. We like to promote random acts of kindness." The other card said exactly the same thing, but with two additional phrases. Rather than just saying, "The Smile Society," the card said, "Who are we? The Smile Society." Rather than just saying, "We like to promote random acts of kindness," the card said, "Why do we do this? We like to promote random acts of kindness." These empty phrases didn't really provide any new information, of course, but they made students feel as though the curious event had been explained. Aha! Now I understand why they gave me a dollar. About 5 minutes later, a different researcher approached the student and claimed to be doing a class project on community thoughts and feelings. The researcher asked the student to complete some survey questions, one of which was, "How positive or negative are you feeling right now?" The results showed that those students who had received a card with the pseudo-explanatory phrases felt less happy than those who had received a card without them. Apparently, even a fake explanation can cause us to tuck an event away and move along to the next one. Uncertainty can preserve and prolong our happiness, thus we might expect people to cherish it. In fact, the opposite is generally the case. When a new group of students was asked which of the two cards would make them happier, 75% chose the one with the meaningless explanation. Similarly, when a group of students was asked whether they'd prefer to know or not know which of the simulated students had written each of the glowing reports in the online chat room study, 100% chose to know. In both cases, students chose certainty over uncertainty and clarity over mystery, despite the fact that in both cases, clarity and certainty had been shown to diminish happiness. The poet John Keats noted that whereas great authors are, quote, capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason, unquote, the rest of us are, quote, incapable of remaining content with half-knowledge, unquote. Our relentless desire to explain everything that happens may well distinguish us from fruit flies, but it can also kill our buzz. Onward. The eye and the brain are conspirators, and like most conspiracies, theirs is negotiated behind closed doors, in the back room, outside of our awareness. Because we don't realize that we've generated a positive view of our current experience, we don't realize that we'll do so again in the future. Not only does our naivete cause us to overestimate the intensity and duration of our distress in the face of future adversity, but it also leads us to take actions that may undermine the conspiracy. We're more likely to generate a positive and credible view of an action than an inaction, of a painful experience than of an annoying experience, of an unpleasant situation that we can't escape than of one we can. And yet, we rarely choose action over inaction, pain over annoyance, and commitment over freedom. The processes by which we generate positive views are many. We pay more attention to favorable information, we surround ourselves with those who provide it, and we accept it uncritically. These tendencies make it easy for us to explain unpleasant experiences in ways that exonerate us and make us feel better. The price we pay for our irrepressible explanatory urge is that we often spoil our most pleasant experiences by making good sense of them. Our tour of imagination has covered a lot of ground, from realism to presentism to rationalization. So before moving on to our final destination, it may be useful to locate ourselves on the big map. We've seen how difficult it is to predict